Hi, Annie.
Hi, Anne.
Long time no vlog.
Yeah. You're in my city.
I'm in New York. I'm in Brooklyn.
I'm so jealous.
The viewers will see this exciting, elaborate environment that I'm in.
I hope it's amazing.
It's really,
yeah,
it's quite something. But
well,
anyway, you know, I'm in Brooklyn Heights, and I'm right next to Columbia Heights, which is a street, a drive, where Norman Mailer lived. So I wanted
I know exactly where you are. Yeah.
I wanted to start off talking. Well, we agreed to this. I'm not just springing this on you, but I wanted to start talking about Norman Mailer, who died a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
He was the most famous, actually, resident of Brooklyn Heights, and I thought I would go out and I was going to go pick up his book, Advertisements, for myself, because I read an essay by Camille Paglia that included her reminiscences about Norman Mailer, and she said that that book had influenced her writing style. So I was just going to ask
whether you thought maybe Camille Paglia was a female Norman Mailer.
Well, I think she took some writing tips from Advertisements for myself, and I think a lot of people who do. I was going back and reading some of his stuff. I wanted to go get Advertisements for myself. I went over to the bookstore here in Brooklyn Heights, where he was the most famous resident, obviously one of the most important writers in the country for many decades. And not only didn't they have like a shrine to him in front of the door, which I think is what they should have had, like all of his books right in front of the door with pictures, and you know, I think that's the way the local bookstore should have been.
How long after his death was this?
A couple of days.
Yeah.
And in fact, there wasn't a book in the whole store. Now, maybe the store was completely picked over and everybody went out and got the book. There wasn't a single book of his anywhere that I could find in the store. So that's
Was
Barnes
it a Barnes & Noble by any
Barnes
chance?
Barnes & Noble, yes.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like the curse of the chain, you know, the idea that the store has no local character. It's just a store from nowhere.
It's a corporate unit from the mothership, wherever that is. And they absolutely, everything that they put in the stores is programmed someplace else in some central.
I just think it's like a slap in the face. It's like saying, we don't care. We're not a real bookstore. You might as well go to Amazon. Why even bother with them?
Right. You might as well be in a mall in,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Durham,
North
Carolina.
Yeah. It gives you that mall feeling. Yeah. And I just felt like it was set. Anyway, even though I wasn't a big Norman Mailer fan, I felt bad that they didn't show respect for the local writers, obviously for a writer of such stature.
I doubt that you ever saw him on the street in Brooklyn Heights because he was ill. You know, I guess he had not been well.
Yeah.
But I did see him on the street in Brooklyn Heights one day.
Oh yeah, how did he look?
My husband has some very good friends who live right there, right on Orange Street near Columbia Terrace, and another friend who inherited a house on Columbia Terrace where we sometimes watch the fireworks on New Year's Eve when they're in the right place for that. But I was walking to their house one day, and I unmistakably saw Norman Mailer coming towards me. And you know how people who are famous, whose pictures you've seen a lot, always sort of look both larger and smaller than life at the same time.
They're always smaller. The celebrities are actually very tiny, right?
Yeah.
You see them in person, and they're shockingly small.
Robert Kennedy was tiny. I saw him in an airport once. But anyway, Norman Mailer looked to me at the time, this must have been, 15 years ago, maybe. He looked like an old sea captain, you know, silver-haired, grizzled, kind of bow-legged, and, you know, he had kind of a rolling walk.
My ex-husband used to work for his literary agent, Scott Meredith, in the 1970s.
Did he really? Yeah.
And at that time, you know, he was just very much, the inside story was that he was very much struggling because he had all of these wives, all of this alimony, and he was always just struggling to get the money together.
I think he was just struggling to be a macho man. I mean, my feeling about him is
maybe
he was
actually kind of a pussy.
He was a sensitive kid, you know, who spent his whole life trying to live it down, kind of.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't get any book, and I when I was back in Madison over the weekend, I got the idea of actually going to the library. I mean, speak of real throwbacks, retro things. I actually went to the university library and, you know, got the book Prisoner of Sex and the old, dingy library book. I pulled it out of the stacks. But I remember
that was the real bombshell, The Prisoner of Sex.
This was like everyone hate all the women, all the feminists hated him.
I did.
When this book came out, I wouldn't have even touched it. I would have regarded it as like venomous, like poison.
Yeah.
That you couldn't even look at it or speak of it. It was just like I won't even touch it.
And you're reading it now, right?
I'm reading it now. Of course, now he's safely dead, so I maybe cut him a little slack because he is a dead person.
Because he's dead.
But it's actually interesting to go back and read it with this kind of distance on it. And to see, you know, because basically what happened was Kate Millett wrote this book, Sexual Politics, I think
right.
It came out in about 1969 or 1970. I went to college in 1969, and I can remember, speaking of holding a book, that was this book that everyone wanted to get a hold of. It was actually the first hardback book I ever bought. I think it was $5.95 or $6.95, first time I ever sprung for a hardback book. But that book was so important to all the women at that time. And
it was well before Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch, which
about a
I
year
think I actually
before.
Like better.
Yeah. Well, that was a different book. Actually, Norman Mailer liked her better too. They kind of got on. They were, but anyway, he was the central villain of that book, and so a lot of what Prisoner of Sex is about is kind of his wounded feelings, kind of trying to fight back, and so not even fight back, but actually reveal a lot of vulnerability. It's kind of interesting from this distance to look at him talking about himself and his relationship to sex. But he said some terrible things. Like he said that women were low, what was the word? Low something beasts, low sloppy beasts. Women at their worst were low sloppy beasts. And the feminists all got mad at him for that.
Yeah.
And then
I didn't get mad at him for that. I got mad at him for saying that only men could create art because, and he had some very Freudian theory about that women create babies, so they and while men have both a womb, which is their brain, and a phallus, and that somehow putting those two together creates, you know, that they were sort of parthenogenetically creating, fertilizing themselves and creating art. Sounds very masturbatory.
Oh, well, that's sort of like saying there's something deficient in a man and then he seeks to make it complete by going to art, and then that's a way of saying that the woman is better than the man because she's
well, no, it's
whole.
Not, because it winds up being a way of saying the man is better than the woman because she only creates, you know, in an animal, vegetable way, and he creates in a conscious, willful way.
But the man
way.
Has a mind because he doesn't have this greater body that the woman has, and then it's a way of putting the woman on the pedestal and keeping
right.
her on.
Woman is nature, man is culture kind of thing.
Yes, and he said that, and this was one of the things that the women got the most upset about, the women, that the essence of being a woman is to find the ideal man and then before, you know, to survive long enough to produce like an improvement to humanity.
Right.
So there's actually, it wasn't just sexist, it was actually racist. It was the kind of thing that no one would say anymore, actually, because, you know, it was basically...
They wouldn't dare. Yeah.
But actually, it was pure Darwinism. I wonder what Bob Wright would say about this, because it was very much about how what a woman should do is find a man who would fertilize her eggs properly so that she could produce a better class of person for the next generation. But
yeah, and also that if she had any sort of strivings or ambitions of her own, that she should live them out vicariously through the man she chose, which was very much a 50s trope anyway. I mean, we were sort of raised to do that. My generation, you know, you wound up, you marry the man you want to be. Somebody said that.
Well, then, you know, this could
you
be
married the life you want, you know.
We weren't planning to talk about Hillary Clinton, right, at this point, but you could very much say that, you know. I mean, didn't she represent kind of that ideal, that sort of 50s Mailer-esque sort of an ideal of living through her husband?
That she always had political ambitions of her own, and that was always...
She wanted,
she didn't go straight to it. Instead, she married this political genius, so-called. Yeah, and it's still, I mean, it's a very bizarre thing that she's presenting being the first lady as experience that suits her for the White House. That is so bizarre. Only she could actually say that. I mean, you cannot imagine Laura Bush running for president. You just can't.
Yeah, and Obama said something just today. I don't know if you saw the news today, but he said, Senator Clinton is claiming basically the entire 8 years of the Clinton presidency as her own, except for the stuff that didn't work out, in which case she says she has nothing to do with it. And then he says that there's no doubt that Bill Clinton had faith in her and consulted with her on issues in the same way that I would consult with Michelle if there were issues. On the other hand, I don't think Michelle would claim that she's the best qualified person to be a United States Senator by virtue of me talking to her on occasion.
That is a role, a behind-the-scenes role that goes all the way back to Pericles and Aspasia, you know, the courtesan who helped him write his speeches. She didn't get credit for it. You know, he did. I mean, if you're going to have a political career, you go out and have it yourself now that you can.
Well, yeah, and there's this whole thing of you're a woman and you want the man, you know, the quality of the man that you have is what what people regard you, that's where, you know, your high regard comes from. So you use what you can to bolster him up so he'll seem like a bigger man. And then that'll make you better.
The Times had an article about some South Carolina ladies who had very interesting things to say about Bill and Hillary. For one thing, they love her because they love him. They all love him. For another thing, there was one or two of them who said she was running the country the whole time, which sounds like a contradiction. But
yes,
one of them said she was running, you know, he was just a good time guy. He was just hanging around, and she was making all the decisions behind the scenes. So she's already been the president as far as this woman is concerned.
On her constitutional terms as president, and she shouldn't be running.
That's for sure. I know.
If she was really the president.
Don't you think, as much as she seemed inevitable at one point, that there's a negativity rising towards her and towards the whole phenomenon that's kind of busting the contest open again?
Yeah, well, people don't like inevitability, so inevitability kind of self-destructs.
That, and also, it's just that people are beginning to go, wait a minute. You know, they're beginning to sort of see the contradictions in her being president after Bill was president. There's something incestuous about it. It's almost like, it is almost like incest.
And almost like a constitutional violation.
Yeah.
Exceeding
almost.
Term
limits. It really is, yeah. I mean, if it was two for one the first time, then she has used up her terms. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
They were both there. So, but to get back to Mailer, we were going to talk about the feminists and Norman Mailer got together in, I think it was 1970. Town Hall here in New York, and they had this big showdown. It was a big historical event in the women's movement, and you were there. There were a lot of, I had a list somewhere of all the famous people who were there. Where did I put that? I lost my list. I've been traveling today. So go on.
My memory of it is not particularly detailed. I remember being disappointed that there weren't more fireworks. Mailer was quite polite and gallant to Germaine Greer, who had also really attacked him, I think.
He kind of liked
did
it.
Attack
did you know,
him
he was passing
stage.
Notes to her, like, you want to go out for a drink afterwards?
He was gallant and gracious.
I think he kind of had the hot spurt, Germaine. She was a little different.
They were well matched in a way. I mean, you know, if you see Camille Paglia as being the female Mailer, you know, he hadn't yet met his match, a woman who could brawl and have as big an ego as he did. And, that's something he wouldn't have minded after all, you know.
So the big showdown, I was thinking it was a little bit like remember the big 70s showdown between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs and the tennis? It was like an era of doing that men and women would actually be put in an arena to see if they could fight.
And it was very new to women. I mean, now you can sort of feel for Norman Mailer's vulnerability, but I think at that point we felt so vulnerable that, you know, we were just bristling with defensiveness about everything he had to say. Now that, you know, now women have proven themselves. Yes. In just about every field there is to prove themselves in. At that time, you know, I went to Harvard before feminism, and it was a horrible place to be. And I've talked about this before, because you were basically considered inferior, and it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't proposition, because if you were excellent intellectually, then you were a hairy-legged blue stocking, and you weren't attractive, and men wouldn't go out with you. So it was sort of like, you really were broken on that dichotomy. And it was a very scarifying thing to live through in that particular environment where excellence was so important.
Yeah, I went to art school at the University of Michigan, and there was a sculpture teacher who was known not to give women couldn't get an A. The best you could do was to get a B because women can't be sculptors.
Women couldn't even get into Yale.
I had a teacher basically when I said I was moving to New York after art school tell me. Offer to give me a number, tell me I needed a sugar daddy, and offer to, try to give me phone numbers.
Yeah, right. And
that was a teacher.
Yeah, right. A lot of that went on, too.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. It was pretty normal.
Yeah.
Those were the days. Speaking of those were the days, I notice, and the way people die in groups, so sometimes related people seem to die together, like when Antonioni died.
And Bergman died on the same day. Like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
I'm going to make a connection between Norman Mailer and Dick Wilson, who played Mr. Whipple in the old Charmin commercials. They're not really on the same level, but I see a sexual theme here, and I just wanted to bring it out. I thought you would
Mr. Whipple was the nonverbal Norman Mailer. He was the mime version, right?
He spoke. He said, ladies, yeah, please, that's right. You know, don't squeeze the charmant. So anyway, but I think it was like the men, women, there was a whole, war of the sexes kind of a theme there. The women would be squeezing these rolls of toilet paper, which I think everybody should agree are obviously vagina symbols. Think about it, roll of toilet paper. So they're squeezing it. I think the women are all getting together in a group and squeezing the Charmin. It's kind of masturbation and sort of women doing it for themselves, I think. Then he would discover them doing that and would chide them about it. No, don't squeeze the Charmin. Of course, there was also then when he was alone, he would do it too.
Yes, so
he was
and there was this conspiratorial expression on his face when he told them not to
do
it.
Yeah, he was actually kind of into it. But I thought that was about... I thought that was about masturbation and kind of repression, but like the last gasps of repression, where it was kind of just a joke and everybody knew that everyone was going to squeeze the Charmin. Is that a correct interpretation? Because to me, that's so obvious. And
Toilet paper is, you know, in that area anyway, to begin with.
Right, the whole issue of toilet paper. Yes.
I think it's a stretch, but, you know, it's an intriguing, what's a sort of a Camille Paglia type
stretch?
I'm
actually not trying to stretch. I'm just trying to point out what was, I think, very obvious. The commercials today have sexual themes, and they don't even try to make it subtle, but I didn't think that was very subtle, and that was a sort of a 70s-era commercial. There were like 500 commercials that guy did, Mr. Whipple.
And then what about the fact that he was so sort of dorky looking? I mean, what did he look like? A school principal or something?
I sort of thought there was a gay theme there. Wasn't there a little bit of... He was an authority figure. But there would be like... He had a supervisor who would come out and catch him. So I think he was actually a kind of a... I thought he seemed maybe a little bit... like maybe we were supposed to perceive him as possibly gay. Or at least an effeminate man.
Oh,
and then he had a supervisor
subtext.
Who would catch him. I don't know. I think you could... James Lilex, who's a really nice essayist.
He's very
columnist,
funny.
He wrote a great column, I'll link to it, about Mr. Whipple, saying, Mr. Whipple was the fellow who tried to impose rules he himself could not follow, and thereby revealed not only the essential hypocrisy of the Puritan impulse, but the uselessness of imposing any sorts of standards on human behavior. And then he goes on to like write it in the style of, you know, like a postmodern kind of academic exercise. And he's writing like that as a joke.
Then what about his name Whipple? It's sort of like whip and nipple, right?
It
has a sadomasochistic tinge
Whip it out. I think about whip it, like a little skinny little dog.
Whipple and tipple and, you know, I mean, it's
nipple,
just got all sorts of
undertones. Yeah, it's reaching in, that toilet paper is reaching into our heads and just massaging our minds.
Imagine the madmen sitting around dreaming that up. Now, how much of that was conscious? It's kind of
You know, I worked in an ad agency in the, speaking of the 70s and things done in the past, I worked at J. Walter Thompson, a big ad agency in the 1970s.
How conscious and devious and manipulative was it? Did they really do things like that on purpose?
No, I think they were really just trying to make really, you know, commercials that would grab people's attention that were really high quality. And remember that there was that book, The Subliminal Seduction.
Persuaders. Well, and there was the hidden persuaders.
No, not hidden persuaders. That's back in the 60s. In the 70s, there was a book called Subliminal Seduction, in which the guy claimed that there was sexual imagery in all the commercials, including that whenever you saw like a glass of
ice, and they poured Coca-Cola over the ice, that there was a nude woman in the ice.
Sex was actually written all over the ice if you would just look at it closely enough. Now I read that book and I thought he was so sure of himself. I said, all right, I guess you're right. And I would look at these pictures and I could never see it. It was just really nutty. But he had claimed that the advertisers were constantly like trying to create images so that something phallic would go in front of a woman's mouth or something like that. That they were constantly manipulating people with sex. But I think nutty. But I do think that the Charmin was about masturbation.
At the time, I just found it extremely annoying. But maybe that's why, you know. Maybe there was something sort of icky about it, sort of like
your uncle
squeezing you in an unpleasant way or something.
Yeah. Like he was like the uncle. Yes, he was a little avuncular or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of sex, we were going to talk about Justice O'Connor and the situation with her husband, who has Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
John O'Connor. And she left the Supreme Court to spend time with him, but she also said she wasn't going to leave until she was replaced. And given the whole situation with Chief Justice Rehnquist dying and then John Roberts going in first and the length of time, and then the whole fiasco with Harriet Myers, it took a long time to get to the point where she really was replaced by Alito. Yeah.
And I don't know whether she at some point put her husband in a nursing home, because he is in a nursing home.
Yes, so by the time she actually got out after leaving the Supreme Court, he really wasn't able to be at home anymore, and she put him in, I don't know, do we use the term nursing home, but some kind of an institution, I think it's a nursing home. And then no sooner did he get there than he struck up a love relationship. He was like a teenager in love, they say.
Right. With and apparently that's not uncommon.
And I think it is quite common. Yeah. And so I know that you have a situation that's a little like that. Your husband lives at home. So I was going to ask you what you thought of the story about Justice O'Connor and the way she's been,
encouraging his romance.
That's what she says. I mean, if you're going to, you don't have to talk about it in public, but if you are going to talk about it in public, what can you say other than, I'm glad he's found some happiness?
Right. Well, I'll bet she really is glad, because, first of all, you know, when somebody's mind has been wiped clean to a certain extent, as Alzheimer's does, I don't know if he still recognizes her. He may, but he may think she's his mother. Mm-hmm. It often happens that, you know, people with Alzheimer's think that their wife is their mother. And in that case, you know, it would be appropriate for him to have a girlfriend, and mom should be glad. Mm-hmm. And by the time it gets that far, you've had time to detach yourself, and you really are not personally hurt by it. In fact, I would guess that she's relieved, because it means that he's not hanging all his emotional dependency on her. She's freer. She undoubtedly feels freer to, you know, maybe not have a man friend or friends of her own, but she doesn't feel that dependency of his. I mean, that focus off her, I would think, would be a relief. Actually,
because it sounds a little bit like when you get divorced, you're happy if the ex-spouse finds someone else, because then it takes the guilt and the connection out of you, and you're able to go on with your life. And
a little bit. It does a little bit like that, yeah. But the other thing is that, you know, he's probably not the person that he was, and so the person that she was in love with is already so effaced and half erased that the loss has already taken place for her, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she can't recreate the relationship that she had with him. And so that he should have a sort of simple, present tense relationship with someone on his own level has got to be, I would imagine, a matter of almost unmitigated relief to her at this point.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not something that suddenly happened. It's not like he suddenly had a stroke and she hasn't had time to get over it. It's a long, slow process.
Right, and it's very hard to picture being in that if you're not in it, because it's a process, and you would just think of how you would feel if it suddenly happened to you.
You're the boiled frog. I mean, the story about this frog being put in the water, and if you gradually raise the temperature, the frog doesn't jump out.
Although, actually,
until it's too late.
they've done that as a scientific. I mean, they've done the experiment. The frog actually does jump out.
Thank you for debunking that urban legend.
Yeah,
but the concept remains appropriate, because you do adapt and adapt and adapt all constantly to new levels of things that you would have thought were unlivable, unthinkable, you know.
But now explain to people who don't know, if you want, about what you've been doing.
Well, that one thing you can say is that we try to generalize about these situations. Actually, they're very different one from another, you know. They're very individual. And so that makes it hard to generalize and hard to think about maybe going to a support group and talking to other people who superficially are in the same situation. But in reality, the details are very different. You know, my husband he knows very well who I am, although there have been times when he did confuse me with his mother.
Now, he doesn't have Alzheimer's. He has a brain injury.
He has something, perhaps, in the Parkinson's family. Mm-hmm. That his neurologist thinks it's pretty much from getting hit on the head too many times as a boxer and as a coal miner in Russia.
So people should know he was a boxer. He was a prisoner in Russia. He escaped from a prison.
And he was hit on the head when he was buried in a coal mine cave-in. So he had lots of blows on the head. Mm-hmm. Then he had lots of surgery and anesthesia for various things later on, knee replacement and stuff. And I don't think the anesthesia does anybody any good, by the way, because he was worse after each operation. But His neurologist thinks it's really sort of like being punch drunk, and it's a very bizarre kind of dementia because he is totally confused about time and place. He doesn't know where he is. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's in New York, or he thinks we're about to leave for New York, or we're about to leave for Japan, or, you know, mm-hmm. he doesn't sometimes distinguish between what's in the room and what's in the television. He thinks that, you know, we can go down to ringside and say hello to the boxers who were watching fight. On the other hand, he's very much himself. He's very witty. He's very thoughtful. He reads. He, you know, you can talk to him about ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's very bizarre.
And you blog about it, so some of the sort of surprising things that he might say that you find wisdom in that, or you find wit, and it's a...
Sometimes he makes jokes. I mean, they're not accidental. Other mm-hmm. times he says things that are accidentally funny, and sometimes he has spells where he can't talk, and then he laughs at himself because of the nonsense that comes out of his mouth. So it's, you know, I think each brain, the brain is a very strange thing, and nobody really knows what's going on in there, so I have experienced the contraction of my world to the point where I, you know, my 4th of July fireworks were the lights behind my eyes when I closed my eyelids, and my, you know, my version of hors d'oeuvres at a bar is to go to Whole Foods and go shopping and eat free samples, you know. I've sort of found a substitute for everything. But
well,
that's,
I mean,
you know, it's
yeah.
boring. It, you know, it's,
yeah.
all I can really say about that is that you may experience it someday, and you really can't predict what it's going to be like because it's different for everybody. Melinda Bruno of Bruno Baby, you know, she and I met on a street corner in the village once and commiserated because her husband had a brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband had a brain illness, and they sort of crossed, you know, there was a time when they were a little bit alike, and then her husband died, and my husband got better. So, you know, it's very hard to generalize.
Did you, but speaking of finding universal things in a story like that, I, after reading about Justice O'Connor, I saw the movie Away From Her, which is directed by, actually, the screenplay was adapted from a story written by Alice Munro called The Bear Came Over the Mountain.
I adore Alice Munro, so I'll have to see.
And the woman who did the adaptation of the screenplay and directed it is named Sarah Polley, and she's only 27 years old. And I saw the movie first and read the story, and it's interesting to me what the 27-year-old added to it in doing the adaptation. And I think that she made it a universal story in a way that said something that wasn't about Alzheimer's disease or mm-hmm. growing old at all.
Mm-hmm.
I found that very interesting. But it's a terrific movie. You should see it. Julie Christie is the woman with Alzheimer's, and her husband has to put her in an institution. And what I thought was interesting and added by Sarah Polley was there's like a tour of the institution where there's a lot of emphasis on the first floor and the second floor. Mm-hmm. And the first floor is for less progressed patients,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of an ironic term. But on that first floor, there's an emphasis on constantly keeping everyone socializing. So all of the residents are always with each other, doing things with each other,
yes.
talking to each other. And then on the second floor, well, we don't even want to see the second floor. But it turns out the second floor is really just a place where you're left in with your solitude.
You lie in bed and you are wherever you are. Yeah.
Yeah, but the fact is, and we have this tendency to think that to be mixing with people and socializing is the real life, and to be left on your own would be more like death or the end of life. But really, I think it gets turned around by Sarah Polley, so that at some point you see that all that enforced socialization really might cause your decline and make you have less of a mind.
That's interesting.
And being on your own and being in a situation where you could especially read, which is what she actually does.
There's something a little totalitarian about all that forced, you know, it's sort of like
socialization.
Prison. It's like prison right. recreation or something.
Right. If you, yeah, it's totalitarian. If you really
yeah.
wanted to make people lose their individuality, what
yeah.
would you do? You would
yeah.
deprive them of solitude.
You have them sitting around in a circle, and they've all got those cottony white heads and wrinkly faces, and they begin to look like they're merging into one life form.
And there's, television and card games and, you know,
by the way, there
regular
is a very good, very smart new blog, which I hope will keep up, called Codename Nora.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written about it, and I'll link to it in the sidebar. It's
okay.
written by a woman in her 80s who is in a retirement community, a retirement home. And it's fascinating because I think it's like junior high school.
Oh, yes, I did look at that. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's like junior high school, but she's a writer, you know, and she really writes wonderfully about that, and she writes about the changes that have happened to her and her body and how she feels about that. And she
as the boomers go to nursing homes, things will be different. I noticed in some of the articles that came out around when the O'Connor story came out, there was some talk about how, you know, with people who had more liberated views about sex end up in nursing homes, there'll be a lot more sex in nursing homes, and it might actually be kind of a problem. Or
you wonder if there will be if they allow them to have Viagra in nursing homes, or whether they try to keep it out.
Or if two people have a relationship and they're not really fully capacitated mentally, when is it rape? I think that there are issues of people abusing.
People
who don't really have all of their faculties.
Facilities.
They have their facility. They don't have all their faculties. On the subject of O'Connor and the courts and rights and so on, I thought we could talk about a little bit about this gun rights case that's going to go up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took cert in a case called Heller. And the D.C. Circuit Court had found that this very tough gun possession law in the District of Columbia was violated the Second Amendment. So the Supreme Court has never really talked seriously about the meaning of the Second Amendment. But back in 1939, they said something about it that had to do with this notion that it's not really an individual right. It's just somehow it's a collective right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that the real idea is that because of the text of it, I don't get the text so I could talk about
the initial intent is to allow you to rise up and protect yourself from a government that's become overweening.
What does that extend to? There's some idea behind it that's suggested by the first clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first clause. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the question is whether, back in this 1939 case, Miller, the court had said that it's just a collective right, that obviously that is only about keeping and bearing arms in the context of being in a well-regulated militia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that if you're outside of that context, then there's just nothing for you in the Second Amendment at all.
Well, except that you have to have your gun handy in case a well-regulated militia should become necessary, which is probably where the gun people take it. You know, need to have that gun handy, and you need to know how to use it, and you need to go out and practice using it, and you need to be ready in case.
But at some point, it becomes an obligation, like a military obligation, to be ready to fight for the state.
Mm-hmm.
To fight against the
state.
But there's been this development of the scholarship around, a lot of it funded by the NRA, drawing out this individual rights idea, which is very close to, I think, what a lot of people just assume it must mean.
Much a libertarian issue, isn't it? Leave me alone with my to have guns if I want and to be responsible in the use of them.
But, we don't get all the libertarian things we want. Obviously, libertarians would say that about drugs and, I guess, any number of things.
Well, I am quite naive on the subject of gun control. I need somebody to give me a lesson on it because, you know, my take on it is that if there are guns, mischief happens more often that wouldn't happen, you know, that becomes lethal where it would only have been perhaps a fist fight, you know.
Right.
People live under enormous stress more and more. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly about the case of a woman who drove up an off-ramp in a case of road rage in pursuit of another woman and got out of her car with her gun and went over to the other woman and shot her. And the woman who did the shooting was a woman who had small children. I mean, she's now in jail. And, you know, people lose it. And if you lose it and you have a gun around, you're probably going to use the gun. And you may have been, a perfectly reasonable citizen and qualified for your permit and everything else. And nonetheless, if there's a gun around, there have been times when I thought that if we had a gun in our house, one of us would have died. You know, because we had really serious fights. And, my husband would say, get me a gun. I want to shoot myself. Well, if there had been a gun around, you know, somebody might have shot somebody. You know, so that's naive.
That's a little paternalistic, though, don't you think? My idea, I think that sounds pretty paternalistic. The government should take our guns away because we might do something bad with them.
Well,
they need to protect us from ourselves. How many?
My understanding is, and again, I know this. I'm aware that this is naive because I haven't finished my conservative re-education yet.
Is that what you're doing?
In countries where guns are much more strictly controlled, there's a great deal less lethal crime. Like Great Britain. Now, that I think that's changed, though. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a criminal underground now that does have guns in Great Britain, and I think things have changed a great deal. But I think there are statistics, and, you know, somebody will come along and correct me, I hope, that show that where guns are regulated, it's a safer world. Now,
well,
you know, you're saying, how can they take our guns
to...
away? But, you know, it's a question of, why do we have guns in the first place?
Well, but if we have guns in the first place, if we are a culture with guns, and then government takes them away, then we've already developed these habits around guns and this sense of entitlement to them.
Yeah.
What I like about people having guns in their house is just I want the kind of people who would break into houses to be afraid that there's a gun in that house. And it doesn't require everyone to have a gun, but if
it requires the burglar not to know whether there's a gun in
there
or not.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. I like the idea that I think the people with guns are doing us all a service because they're creating this unknown that you don't know where the guns are.
That's a great point. And I always cheer when, you know, somebody breaks into someone's house and the guy shoots him dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has every right to do that. It's self-defense and defense of his territory and his property and his family. And,
well,
you know,
there's some
that always makes me cheer, so I'm not a...
Really?
You know,
even if they don't give the person a chance to run off or just hold them on... I mean, some people... There was a 9/11 recording that was played on the radio, and it's available on the internet, of a guy who is... You can hear the whole 9/11 recording. He's looking out the window. He's seeing burglars breaking into an empty house next door. And he's telling them, you know, I have a shotgun. I'm not going to let them leave. I'm going to go out. I'm going to shoot them. And the 9/11 operator is saying, no, don't go out there. Don't shoot them. You know, human life is more important than property. And we hear the whole thing with the 9/11 operator trying to talk him out of him. We hear him go out there and shoot the people.
And you hear the blast.
And he kills two people. Yes, you hear it all.
Yeah.
You hear it all. And then, I think people, but I wanted to talk about how just the fact that the Supreme Court is talking about this now in an election year is going to affect both before the decision comes out and after the decision comes out, how it's going to affect the different candidates. For example, I noticed that Fred Thompson has started to talk about Second Amendment rights a lot.
Yeah.
So not just to say...
That's very Western, too. It's very important in the West.
Yeah, not just to say, Giuliani favored gun control, but to actually say, I support Second Amendment rights. So it's a way of kind of raising it to a higher level and connecting it to a whole lot of other issues that are about constitutional rights and constitutional interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to take something that seems actually sort of low, using guns, shooting guns, and making it something lofty and connected to the whole history of the United States and connected to all these other rights and so on.
I'm curious how people square that reverence for the Constitution when it comes to the Second Amendment with the desire to amend the Constitution to make abortion a crime and to make gay marriage impossible.
Yeah, I was connecting it to how will people who support gun control connect that and want to say the Second Amendment is just a collective right, it's not an individual right.
Mm-hmm.
How will they then be able to say, but I support the right of privacy, abortion rights, et cetera, you know, that I'm for a broad interpretation of constitutional law with respect to the things I like. And then
broad
the other
and
thing that I don't.
Yeah, but it needs to be consistent. And people pick and choose often.
Yeah. I think there'll be a lot of room to call people on their hypocrisy or to make a show of not being hypocritical while somebody else is.
And to call them on their changing their positions, to tailor themselves to the current mood, because Rudy was very pro-gun control as the mayor of New York.
Well, I mean, of course, everyone does what they have to do. When he was running for mayor in New York, he had to fit New York. Obviously, he's going to change now. Fred Thompson was never in that position.
Right. It's disturbing, though. I hate seeing them change. It makes me feel as if they're only products being sold and they don't really have any backbone, you know?
Yeah. Although that just means you'll be stuck with someone who was never in a complex situation and never had to adjust. Like Fred Thompson, what did he ever have to do?
Right.
He was never in a complex situation.
White's action, that's about as complex as it got for him.
Yeah. But also running from Tennessee, you know, he could take all of these positions and now he can be consistent with them. Does that mean he's really going to be good at being president? Maybe not. When he gets in a complex situation, what skills will he bring to that? He's never had to do, he has no experience dealing with a complex situation, does he?
Well, I really don't think he does. And Huckabee, who was a governor of a state and who says he learned that you cannot govern from ideology, he interested me very much for a while. I followed him. I even contributed.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out why you were so high.
I even contributed to his campaign. Because he was the, I'm sure I didn't make a difference, but there were many knees, it would have made a difference. He interested me because he was the social conservative that you could agree to disagree with if you were a moderate. He was the guy who said...
Why? Just because
he was the guy who said the right to life doesn't stop at the birth canal. So he was obviously interested in something other than being obsessed with
abortion. So in other words, he's not a conservative. He's just sort of a liberal on the sort
he's a social conservative, and he has come out and said that he wishes for a human life amendment to the Constitution and a defense of marriage, federal constitutional amendment.
But on like fiscal stuff, on economic stuff, he's not conservative.
Well, the Club for Growth is very much against him, and he makes fun of them. He's a populist. If you've ever seen one of those grids that divides the political landscape into four instead of two, there are people who are sort of authoritarian populists, you know, who are socially conservative but believe in an activist government and a big government and in taking care of people's
needs. That's my least favorite quadrant of the
Is it really? Yeah.
Yes. I think. Let me think what the other... why would you want that? It just seems to be the most controlling of all of the categories.
Well, I think
he's sort of pleasing because he has a nice demeanor. I mean, he's a very likable guy.
And he's a rock musician. He's smart and personable.
Yeah.
No, but because when he talks about gay marriage, or when he talked about gay marriage a few months ago when he was courting moderates, he said things like, I think marriage should be between a man and a woman, and let's work on keeping those in better shape before we start minding everybody else's
business. The president is going to stop people from getting divorced? How is he going to do that? I think that's a silly subject.
Maybe encourage people to be smarter about getting married in the first place.
He was involved in that covenant marriage stuff.
I can see a culture that would encourage people not to divorce impulsively, especially if they have kids. You know, that would encourage them to perhaps think about something other than their own personal restlessness to get on with their authentic lives.
Does that have to do with President of the United States? I mean, maybe governors could have something to do with that, but it just seems to me totally off the subject of a president.
Of what a president should be doing governing?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, it's the bully pulpit. It's one of the things that conservatives loved Ronald Reagan for.
I could live
for making those statements.
The president
and they're really
telling us not to get divorced.
Yeah. They're not a whole lot more than statements, though. I mean, I sort of lost interest in Huckabee for two reasons. One is that he stopped talking to people like me and began pitching himself to the base because no one else was doing that effectively. And my theory is that he has a deal with Giuliani. I think he's going to focus on the base, and then he's going to hook up and be Giuliani's vice presidential candidate if Giuliani doesn't get torpedoed by the whole Bernie Kerik mess. If nothing substantial comes out through that really hurts Giuliani's candidacy, and it may not.
I was reading. Did you see that cover story in Newsweek that I think just came out today or yesterday?
Yeah, I'm sort of in the middle of it right now, reading it online.
Now, it seems to me that Newsweek, it's like a huge cover story in Newsweek. Newsweek had every motivation to really dig into that story and find out whatever that dirt was between Kerik and Giuliani. Mm-hmm. Now's the time to play it, to bring it forward. They were doing that whole story. The closest they get to it is this. Let me just read a little quote from the City Hall Records. City Hall Records, reviewed by Newsweek, suggest that the mayor may have been briefed on some of the problems about Kerik just before Kerik was appointed commissioner.
Right.
But Giuliani said he had no memory, and his tight palace guard remains closed mouthed. So that's
people's memories.
They found nothing. Yes, but see, this is the thing, is they don't have anything.
Yeah.
So they're just developing this theory that people are loyal to Giuliani, and Giuliani has this big thing with loyalty. That's just a narrative they made up. And it is in place of any information. They have nothing on him. They had every reason to look for it.
Right.
They admit, they try to make it sound like it's something, but it's nothing.
Yeah.
They found nothing. And so they're just like, and he said nothing. Oh, so he has no memory. But Giuliani says he has said he has no memory. I said, oh, maybe he's lying, but they have nothing. And they
I heard a tone of admiration in that article. I think we are so in love with toughness now. And we're in love with realism. We are not in mm-hmm. love with idealism.
Yeah.
And people are admiring the people who say, the Democrats who say, well, we would, you know, we wish it could be Obama, but we really want it to be Hillary because she's like Richard Nixon. Michael Reynolds said that. And other people have said the same thing. They are attracted to that Nixonian toughness in Hillary, and they're attracted to that sort of, you know,
maybe
boss, if not mob boss, toughness in Giuliani.
Oh, maybe people also like pragmatism and just realism, as you said. And that these people who come forward with an idealistic position like Huckabee or Obama, it really doesn't inspire much confidence that they'll be able to do the job.
Find myself comparing Huckabee and Obama a lot, which is bizarre because they're on the face of it nothing alike.
That.
But
no,
they're both people.
I think that this is it. I think this is it. They are alike.
You know what? My camera's zooming in now. I told you this was going to happen. It's going to end. It's going to end like a movie with a close-up of my pores. This camera slowly zooms and it rips itself loose from the duct tape.
Well, can you fix it? And I'll.
I'm trying, and it makes for an interesting picture.
We go for the visual effects here on Blogging Heads.
I plastered the duct tape down again, but it was definitely starting to do its little. It was definitely stalking me. Huckabee and Obama remind me of each other in the sense that they're both smart politicians with probably centrist instincts
mm-hmm.
who have both had to dutifully pander to their respective bases. And
they
who are a lot less interesting.
So then they're not idealistic. They're pragmatic. They've just identified a niche, and the niche is about idealism, but they themselves aren't
idealistic. The appeal
to
the base, strangely enough, the bases are idealistic.
Right,
think
but
about
the politician
it.
That gets into that niche is just being as pragmatic as everyone else.
The bases are idealistic, and you have to appeal to them to be pragmatic. It's very paradoxical.
Right.
You know, there are certain buttons you have to press and certain things that you have to say to either be, I mean, if you're a Democrat, abortion is virtually sacred. And
well, you
abortion,
know, I wanted to
no
ask about...
No restrictions.
I wanted to ask about abortion and this gun rights issue, because it seems to me that...
Did you hear that debate, that last Democratic debate, when every single Democratic candidate said that they wanted judges who would uphold Roe v. Wade as settled law? It was as if they were, you know, making a catechism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were sticking their dollar bill in the statue of the saint in Little Italy. It was
you're
just
talking about
that
the Democrats
ritualistic.
Or,
the last Democratic debate.
Well,
they were asked if they would appoint judges, you know, and they all basically had the litmus test that the base expects.
They
them.
Usually deny that it's a litmus test. Even
well,
they
I don't think
sound...
they used the words litmus test. They found fishy ways of wording it, but they all said that they wanted, they all paid homage to Roe v. Wade, basically. And on the conservative side, you have to say, you know, if you're Mike Huckabee and you're trying to vote, you know, corral the base, you have got to say that you want a human life amendment, even though you know, if you're a smart politician, that there will never be one. You know, the Constitution is not going to be amended to make abortion equivalent to murder.
Right. You know, people don't understand that. I was on a right-wing radio show a year or so ago talking about an abortion case in a previous Supreme Court term. And it was clear that these radio show guys who were trying to do a show on the subject, that they didn't understand. They thought if Roe v. Wade were overturned, it would be that the Supreme Court found that the fetus is a person with rights. That, and I'm saying, no,
that's
not
a whole
what
separate
mean.
Step.
That's
that
not what it would mean
by...
if Roe v. Wade was. So people don't, you know, as a law professor, I kind of can lose touch with how much people understand constitutional law. And sometimes I'm just struck and just shocked by how little they grasp it. So even people who think they're pretty expert about it and are talking about it don't understand what they're saying. They think overruling Roe v. Wade means that the fetus
abortion
has a right
will be
to
illegal
life.
Overnight. Yep.
And I mean, it's interesting. I'm actually quite interested in the sort of folk beliefs in rights, like gun rights. You know, people believe there's a Second Amendment right. They have a right to have a gun. And it's sort of like, it doesn't even matter all that much what the Supreme Court really says. There's like a culture of believing in rights.
It doesn't even matter what the Constitution really says, because it may not say that.
And if the Supreme Court says the wrong thing, people will just think the Supreme Court got it wrong, and it'll affect politics. Like Roe v. Wade activated a certain side of politics. The Yale Law professor Jack Balkin had a nice piece after the gun case, after the court took cert in
this
the gun
recent
case.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Saying that, trying to predict the effect of the outcome of the case on the presidential election, on the theory that if the Supreme Court found that there were individual rights in the Second Amendment, it would activate, it would help the Democrats because it would, you know, scare the people who want there to be gun control, and they would get vitalized, similar to the way the pro-life people were vitalized by Roe v. Wade. Well, and, of course, if it went the other way and they said there are no rights in the Second Amendment, it's just that Miller thing of collective rights, that would really light a fire under some people.
Under the NRA, certainly, yeah. It's, some of these things are quite irrational in their emotional importance to people, and you wonder what's really behind the passion.
What do you mean?
What's behind the passion for guns? I mean, there's a whole complex behind that that's very interesting. What's behind the pro-life passion? What's behind the pro-abortion passion? There's more. There's always so much more there than meets the eye.
We could drag Norman Mailer back into this. What would he say?
Norman Mailer belongs back here, and Germaine Greer, who ended by writing a book about regretting not having children, so she sort of came full circle. After all of her determination to claim culture and art and all of that, she came back and said, you know, I missed the big thing about being a woman. Did you know that?
I didn't remember when she did that, but I think, maybe she was someone who tried to catch the wave of the moment and find fame as a writer by saying what was helpful to say at a particular time. You know, speaking of getting into a niche that is convenient and...
Well, not only that, but just when you're making huge change with your own life, sometimes you don't get around to doing everything else you'd like to do.
Yeah, it was that old greeting card. I think goes back to the 70s too. Oh my God, I forgot to have children.
Yeah, right.
It was like.
But who's the artist who does the
Roy Lichtenstein?
Right.
Yeah. I think everyone knew at the time that you might be forgetting to have children, and it might be too late.
I suppose that Mailer would say that the gun thing has to do with the phallus, but that would be boring and Freudian. I don't think it's about that. I really don't think it's about that.
Yeah, the Freudian stuff doesn't play as well as it used to. It used to be just assumed that you could make a Freudian analysis of everything and that everybody
And that makes
knew
him
it.
Seem very dated, his sort
of
Freudian
thing. Yeah, that does seem
thing.
Dated.
I mean, I think guns may have to do with manhood and independence and the whole sense that, you know, you are the head of your family and you protect your family. The state does not, and you don't want it to. You don't want it to feed your family, and you don't want it to protect your family. That's your job as the male head of the household. I think there might be some of that there.
Right.
But it has to do with independence.
Rejecting
and
the
it has
nanny
to do with,
state.
Yeah.
The nanny state is the female state. That ties to this whole idea that the Republicans are the men and the...
The mommy party and the daddy
party.
Mommy
party and the daddy party, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the daddy party will help you keep your guns, keep your whatever.
Right. Right. In a sense, that's very interesting to see the divide of the country, which is just about 50-50, as being a gender divide. A divide about which sex is dominant and which sex is sort of ethos is dominant. And, of course, there are men who side with the feminine and women who side with the masculine. But that's an interesting way to look at it. And that Mailer would go for that, I think.
Yeah. Well, but with Hillary Clinton, she's actually seems more masculine than the other Democrats in terms of the things she represents.
To bring in another slightly obscene image, she's straddling the divide pretty effectively.
Right.
Which is why you can imagine her being a president. You can imagine her being president.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I've written a lot of anti-Hillary posts, and I feel a lot of antipathy toward her, but at the same time, I feel like what I'm really feeling is my resistance to what I feel like I feel the inevitability of that. I picture myself ultimately voting for her just because I think that she is, not because I think she has the relevant experience or has all the policies that I want, but just because
she has
I think she has the ability that she will be able to deal with the situations that arise and the complexity of the job and actually do it. But I don't like her, so
no, I know. I share your ambivalence. I mean, she really seems as a person to have the capacity and the kind of and the sort of strength, the sort of authority to be president. I agree.
And you know,
like Maggie Thatcher, or, you know, I mean, she's not like anything like Maggie Thatcher. Yeah. She's much too much of a statist, I think, really, in her heart of hearts. But,
right.
You know, but, that's the problem with her, that she's is the type of president.
I don't really feel like I need to like the president. Generally, in life, I haven't liked any president. You know, the first president I voted for, you know, and I started voting in 72, was Bill Clinton. First time the person I voted for became president was Bill Clinton. Who I later didn't like so much, but the whole thing of why should you have, you know, and it's sort of like with Bush. People think that I love Bush because I don't criticize him about the war and certain things like that, but I don't love him. I just don't. I think it's a little babyish to think that you're supposed to love the leader, and I think dangerous too.
It's not.
I think
it's not your parent.
You don't have to like these people.
Yeah. Michael Reynolds says it's your employee. It's not your parent. It's somebody you hired to run things. It's a manager, and you want him to be a competent manager above all.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're not hiring a boyfriend.
If it was, and that really, the interesting thing about it is that that does make her marriage irrelevant, and that's the sense in which her marriage is really the first modern or postmodern marriage that's been, like, oh, well, maybe, my camera's creeping up on me again. maybe you could say Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, in her charitable way, in her charitable aristocratic way, had her own, you know, her own thing. But never before has there been a, you know, a first lady who was just a politician in her own right. And she really doesn't owe that to her marriage. She really owes that to who she is, I think, and to what she's always wanted to do and be. So again, you know, if she was up against Giuliani, I might not vote for her. But I do think that she's, you know, come across as presidential. And she's made me forget about her being a woman, which is kind of a litmus test for me. It goes into the background. Yeah. You know what I mean?
She's at her worst when she plays the gender card. She's all the bullying.
Right.
Gang
I agree with you.
She just should forget. Just not do that at all. I don't want to hear about that at all anymore. Don't use that. You know, I went back.
I think she's doing it because it worked for her with that Lazio thing. I think it's purely pragmatic.
When she originally ran for senator from New York, she was in a debate with Rick Lazio. I did a post about it recently. It was actually very hard to find the old video. I started to develop a conspiracy theory that she'd suppressed it. really not much happened. He was not a very good candidate, and he did a kind of a dumb stunt of coming over trying to get her to sign a piece of paper.
Waved paper in her face, kind of, right?
Not really. It was stupid. Yeah. He wasn't a very good candidate. But the thing that she did was that afterwards she spun it as something that a man did wrong to a woman. And she totally played the gender card, and it worked. Yeah. And so now there's a sense that it worked before, maybe it'll work again. But I think running for president against genuinely competent candidates, it's
bad idea.
Don't suddenly get all helpless and fainty.
Yeah, I totally
don't want a president like that. Oh, men offended you? Men overwhelmed you? And I don't want to hear about it. It's not a very good approach.
How are you going to go up against Vladimir Putin if men, you know, if men, mean men, offend you?
Yeah, yeah. Or that, you know, we're supposed to support you because we feel protective of you. I don't want to have to feel like I have to protect the president. Let the president protect me.
That's going to give people second thoughts about her, too, I think. I mean, there are many reasons why this election will go through many more cycles of up and down and disillusionment and reinfatuation with different candidates. I mean, I think now people are looking again at Obama. People are looking again at McCain. And, you know, the people are already a little sick of the front runners, and the bloom is off of, the infatuation is over. But it's going to go through many more changes like that. But there are a lot of reasons for people to have second thoughts about Hillary. And I agree with you. I think you're right that she's playing into one of them heavily. If she overplays the gender card, she's going to undercut her own leadership.
And, you know, I hate when she talks about, wouldn't it be exciting to have the first woman president? Because to me, she is the spouse of a former president. She is a woman who made it on a man's coattails. And I don't like the idea of the first woman president being someone who did that. So this idea of her getting that position as the first woman president, I don't like that at all. So I don't want to hear
that at all.
Well, that's
actually, you know, that's there you're being idealistic rather than pragmatic, because look at most of the women leaders in the world inherited their positions. You know, from Eva Peron down. Benazir Bhutto's father was a dictator, and
Zulfikar
Ali Bhutto, and Corazon Aquino's husband was not the president, but he was a candidate when he was assassinated.
But this is the United States, and after all these years, I think when we finally get a woman president, it should be someone who had done it in her own right. Now, maybe she will be the first woman president, and therefore she wouldn't be one who did it in her own right. So don't make such a big deal about the fact that you'd be the first woman president, because
you have to say she was not your typical first lady. Because your typical first lady, you would never envision ever being president.
And
the notion of that even being a qualification for to be president is ridiculous.
Although, as time goes on, there'll be more and more high-achieving men will be married to high-achieving women. So these power couples will be much more prevalent.
High-achieving men are marrying those women.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is the way things will be in the future. Yeah. So I think the past of these sort of retirement...
See, I really don't think of her as coming in on his coattails. I really think of them as having been a partnership from the beginning. Whatever was going on between them personally, I think they've always... I know she raised Chelsea and she stayed home and he was the one who ran for office, but I think that she always had her own career and she always had her own ambitions, and I don't feel that coattail feeling about her. It's not like she was somebody's daughter or, you know, widow or something.
But she found a man who had the qualities that she lacked, and she would have never gotten into this position without his, you know, political genius
and his charisma and warmth and all that. Yeah, she was kind of a cold fish, but then maybe he never would have gotten there without her either.
I don't like this. Well,
she had
I
the
guess
qualities
that's the,
that he lacked, you know.
It's like the you complete me ideal of a marriage. Maybe we should.
Which
be
comes
happy
back
about
to why
that.
I don't want her in the, you know, in the White House. I don't want them in the White House again, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's that's going to make people's gorge rise as they think about it. The more they think about it.
It'll be great theater. It'll be some great blogging.
It already is.
Hey, I think we went through all our topics, did we?
There are always more, you know. You never
Oh, finished. You know what you didn't talk... No, wait, there's one thing you were going to talk about you didn't talk about. You know Judith... Is it Regan or Reagan?
It's Regan.
Judith Regan has filed this crazy, it seems crazy, lawsuit, like $100 million lawsuit against her publisher for firing her from her lofty job she had her own imprint.
And she made buckets of money for HarperCollins, so there's speculation that it's because of Fox's ties to Rudy Giuliani that they are...
She has that in the complaint, but it just, if you read it, it just sounds kind of nutty, so...
Yeah.
But you
it's
know
only
her.
At one small point in the complaint, which is, you know, basically for improper dismissal and violation of contract. But she claimed way back, and she was quoted in a New Republic story, which I think is no longer online. I wasn't able to find it, but I still have the post that I wrote on it, and I quoted some substantial parts of it. So I'll put in a link to that, where she said that she had dirt on Carrick and Giuliani, that they discussed what she called sketchy activities in front of her as if she wasn't there. Both of them.
She had a love affair with Carrick, obviously. Everyone
she had
that.
What?
She had a love affair with Carrick.
She had a love affair with Carrick.
I'm not making this up.
And she broke up with him because he was having a simultaneous love affair with another woman and his wife was pregnant. She was furious when she found out his wife was pregnant. And then apparently after she broke up with him, he stalked her and threatened her in certain ways, or at least so she claimed. She said that she confided in people that she was absolutely terrified of him after they broke up, which also doesn't make him sound like a very savory character, but then neither is she.
You worked with her in some capacity, or you knew her in some way?
I met Judith Regan two decades ago when she was a baby editor. She had just come from the National Enquirer, where she was a reporter, and she was in a tiny little office at Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, she got started at National Enquirer. Yeah.
I had some friends who knew a lawyer, a woman lawyer, who had worked with Ted Bundy on death row and wanted to write a book about Ted Bundy. And Judith Regan was interested in this book. However, she was... very principled at the time. She absolutely would not publish the book unless the lawyer, who was a little bit in love, who was one of those creepy women who was a little bit in love with Ted Bundy, admitted that he was a monster. And the woman wouldn't admit that he was a pure monster, and Judith Regan wouldn't publish the book. So she took this very principled stand. Same woman who, you know, two decades later is publishing O.J. Simpson's hypothetical confession.
Yeah.
And, you know, claiming that she's doing it because she's sticking up for abused women. I mean, that's always her position, that she's fighting for women and for abused women. And I think she's a loose cannon, but there's a part of me that enjoys it. There's a part of me that thinks, you know, it's the revenge golem of women, the superheroine, you know.
It seems this complaint, this, like, a rambling complaint that has all kinds of, there's this...
The kitchen sink is in there, right?
I'm going to link to this piece by Roger Parloff, the legal editor at Fortune magazine, who goes through it and basically says, you know, if she'd have just stopped at making her basic point that she didn't make an anti-Semitic comment, which is what they said they were entitled to fire
her
for.
Right.
If she'd have just stopped there, it would have made sense as a lawsuit, but instead it's sort of like she's hanging herself with her own rope, that she's telling that the way she tells the story is itself the argument against her, because it's so flaky, it's so weird.
That's Judith.
It collapses on itself. You know, she's condemned by her own words. You know,
she went through a horrible divorce for years and years, and she told everybody about it. You know, she would, if you walked in and you were a total stranger, she'd start telling you about her horrible ex-husband and what he'd done to her regarding her daughter, and you know, she doesn't have any boundaries.
But I really hate to see that in a legal complaint. I don't think lawsuits should be used like that. But the whole angle with Giuliani, I mean, there's like a part of it that's about Giuliani that is sort of like she knows something about him, and it was a conspiracy to destroy her reputation so that she wouldn't be able to use it.
That's what
but
she
it's
implies.
Sort of like, that's
now,
what
we'll
she's
see
saying.
We'll see if she can deliver. You
but
know.
If that's true, say whatever it is. Why hasn't she said it? This is like the thing with Newsweek magazine that I was saying before. If there's something there, if you're saying you've got something, why aren't you saying what it is now?
Well,
you've got
to remember that she's a publicity hound, you know, second only to Princess Diana, and she may be waiting for the climactic moment. I mean, if she has anything, she may not. And if she does, she may be unable to prove it. People may not take her seriously. Giuliani will say she's just a nutcase. But if she has anything, she could be saving it for, you know, the eve of his nomination.
Yeah, well, this is what's frustrating. I mean, I'm afraid he'll get nominated and then all the bad stuff will come out after we've committed to him. If there's something about him that we shouldn't go for him, I want to hear it now. Why aren't they bringing it out now? Or are they just holding it in reserve?
Mystifying. Does somebody have a last-minute... October surprise kind of thing in store.
I just
can't
believe that if there is something there, that everybody would be on the same page with it, that everybody would be holding it in reserve. It seems to me there's all these insinuations. Bring it
and
out.
And some of it's the usual, you know, smear of Italian-Americans, like with Mario Cuomo.
Right.
Well, he must have mafia connections. He was a big
and
city
the
mayor. Even
if
he wasn't Italian, he'd have mafia.
The Newsweek article is full of that. All of this stuff about just the fact that he has... friends, that he has people that he works with and he's loyal, or anything about loyalty gets sort of this extra oomph built into it, that it's some sort of a mafia story.
And really at the same time, they sound like they admire it. You know? They go very easy on that. They say it, but they say it kind of like, boy, didn't you love The Sopranos kind of thing, you know? We love The Sopranos, and you know, maybe that's not so bad.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's going to be
glamorous now, that little whiff of whatever is a little bit glamorous, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you want that in the president of the free world when you're dealing with Islamic terrorists.
Toughness,
you know.
If we get Giuliani and Hillary Clinton as the as the nominees, it's going to be very very multi-layered and complex to observe. So.
Well, you don't like you're having a spat with Andrew Sullivan, and he's saying stupid things about you, but he had a really interesting article.
What? Andrew Sullivan is saying...
What?
What?
Andrew Sullivan.
Is saying things about me?
No, well, you have said things about him saying things about you. I don't go read him, I just read you, so...
You know, so many things get said about me that I actually forget what they were. I'm like, oh, am I supposed to be mad at that person?
I don't remember what they were either, but I do remember that you were annoyed at him. But anyway,
probably.
He basically says that people are feeling a renewed interest in Obama because he would break us out of this baby boom Punch and Judy show between the right and the left that started with Vietnam. You know, where it's just become this repetitive back and forth and back and forth, and Clinton and Bush and Bush and Clinton, you know, where they're bashing each other over the head, and they take turns bashing, and it says, I, you know, did not, did so. thing that the baby boomers are into that the country desperately craves to be released from, and that the only way to release it is to bust out of this generation that has Vietnam like an albatross.
I think that's silly and prejudiced, the idea that a generation has a character and that the next generation will be different. Of course, that's what baby boomers themselves thought.
It's baby boomers' own. I mean, Andrew Sullivan is a baby boomer, so.
But the idea that the next generation isn't going to be at each other's throats, they're not going to be divisive, why would that happen?
Right.
We're human beings.
The divisions will at least be different, that it'll somehow be a different can of worms, and it'll be refreshing in that respect, you know. So, and that's why people are looking at McCain again, because he too is not a baby boomer. He's older. Yeah. And that it wasn't so much, it was the fights, the battles that we keep refighting obsessively, you know, the sort of post-traumatic Vietnam syndrome that he was saying that we're still fighting. You know, there was the silent majority, and then there was the counterculture, and there were the people who opposed the war, and there were the people who fought in the war, and, you know.
Seems to me we just haven't gotten enough. It's not fair to the baby boomers. We all we got was Clinton and George, and the second Bush. That's the sum total of the baby boomer presidents.
It's pretty pathetic.
I think we're entitled to at least one more.
And they were both born the same year as me, which is not pleasing to me at all. I don't think it speaks well for us to be represented by those two.
Although I can, and then we're a particularly large group, so there should be more of us, seems to me.
Yeah. Also, the boundaries have blurred a great deal. I mean, when I was in college and just after, there seemed to be a huge divide between me and the World War II babies who were on the other side of this huge cultural, you know, apocalypse thing. And now that divide is just gone, and I'm looking at these people and I'm thinking, you know, he or she used to seem so old to me, and she's only in her 60s. You know, I'm in my 60s. We're like, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing how young it seems when you actually get there. Anyway, well, we've gone over an hour. I was going to say we should try to keep it to an hour this time so we don't...
But great stuff, and I'm glad you brought in some of the stuff that you know so well about the Supreme Court, because that's... That's meat and potatoes.
Okay.
We're not talking about boobs this time, unless you count all those politicians. Okay.
So, is that it?
That's fine with me.
Okay. Anything else you want to say?
We can call it an evening. We can call it an evening.
Okay. Time to stop with the water and get some dinner and move on.
Yes, and I raise my virtual glass of wine to you in front of your skyline. And eat my heart out.
It's quite something.
Uh-huh. I know.
You're going to be amazed at the amazing panorama.
I know, and what have I got behind me? A couch and a bag full of underpads and, you know, I don't know what all. Sad.
Okay, well, it was great talking to you again.
Great to talk to you.
After all these months of not vlogging, doing another vlog, a diet vlog. So
enjoy my city.
Okay.
All right. Okay. See you soon.
See you.